The issues that matter most, right here. The Drew Mariani Show
on Relevant Radio.
Over the last several years, doctors, medical experts, and the media have all said that the best way to help adolescents in distress about their gender is to give them puberty blockers, hormones, and surgeries to align their physical sex with their gender identity. The alternative to doing so, they said, was suicide. But now a new study released last month found no scientific evidence to support the claim that drugs and surgeries prevent suicide among people with gender dysphoria. Now, I agree we should be concerned about children and adolescents experiencing distress about their biological sex. But now there's even more evidence to warrant greater caution in how we treat them.
It's the Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Yeah, that was Michael Schellenberger. He is on the WPATH files, and interesting study. He's talking about suicide rates for those who have transitioned. Research on the mental health outcomes of individuals who have undergone gender transition surgery. It's complex, but it's often pretty high. There's a new book out. It just came to us here at the network. It's called The Detransition Diaries. I don't know if you know, but today is also Detransition Awareness Day. It's weird. One of those weird days. I wasn't aware of it until a couple weeks ago. But there are a lot of people right now who are being pulled in by this lie that they're not in the right bodies. And it's seriously messing with a lot of people's lives. And maybe you have somebody in your family or extended family, somebody you love, somebody you work with. I think it's really important to be in the know on this. Fortunately, there's some people in Britain right now starting to get it. The National Review was reporting earlier, actually this afternoon, that the National Health Service is no longer going to prescribe puberty blockers to kids except those who are in clinical trials. And that comes just a few days after, 100 pages of files from the World Professional Association for Transgender Health, or that audio you just heard, WPATH, were leaked to the press. And this is a group of people who've proclaimed themselves to be experts in so-called gender medicine and developed standards of care to be followed. But according to what's in these files, the members of the group, just disregarding the most basic ethical principles like informed consent. So you can expect anybody under the age of 18 to be understand, I hope they understand there's ramifications for getting puberty blockers or having healthy body parts cut off. A 10-year-old child, 12-year-old, 13, you're not mature enough to make those decisions. 15 years old, you're not mature enough to make those decisions. Even people in their 20s don't get it. Why? Because there are certain mental health issues that might be at play. One patient had PTSD, major depressive disorder. They observed, all sorts of, they had schizoid typical type of traits, and psychiatrists were recommending holding off on giving this person treatments. But, one of the developers of the standard of care wrote back, said, am I missing why you're perplexed? And went through to advocate that this takes place. If you've got somebody in your family that's dealing with this, maybe they're being pressured right now by teachers or counselors or peers or social media, sometimes even parents, unfortunately, who will regret it later. They think they're doing their child they're helping their child become the person that they were intended to be. Quite often you got to pick up the pieces of a child's life, and really the family, much later. I'm joined right now by Jennifer Lull. She is the co-author of a new Ignatius book entitled The Detransition Diaries, which documents seven people who went through this and then decided to back off. If you have somebody in your life, you may want to check out this book. It's good to have her with us today. Jennifer, good afternoon.
Hi, it's good to be with you. Thank you for having me on your show.
So, let's start with the news first. The leaked documents from the World Professional Association for Transgender Health, did that surprise you at all?
No, not at all, because we knew that this scandal was going to have a very short shelf life once people started hearing some of the stories from the detransitioners and what is really happening with medical care. And I use that lightly, especially in the United States. You opened with the fact that this is Detransition Awareness Day today. It's the third year in a row now, and with the news coming out of the National Health Services that they're no longer going to block puberty on young children because there's no scientific basis for this procedure or prescription. It's truly a great day. I mean, I've always said that this is one of the medical scandals that we will see come to a grinding halt in our lifetime. So it's a good day.
I had a man named Walt Heyer, who wrote a book called Sexual Regret, or My Sexual Regret. I forget the exact title of the book. Sex Change Regret. And he also has a website, sexchangeregret.com. And he talked about how, you know, as a child, he went through some trauma and ultimately transitioned and lived as a woman for 8 years. And he transitioned ultimately back. And we've talked about suicide rates. I look at Bruce Jenner, who is not, you know, he hasn't changed his genitalia, but clearly is trying to, you know, he cross-dresses and things along those lines. Is the suicide rate for people who struggle in these areas or who have to carry this particular cross, how high is that? What drives that? And what's being done to caution people who want to go down this lane that, you know, there are side effects to this, not just physiologically, but psychologically?
Yeah, well, the evidence doesn't bear out the statement that if you don't allow people to transition, and first, just for your listeners' sake, I don't believe you can transition. You're born a natal man. You're born, you know, as a female. You will die as a man or a woman. But the evidence actually bears out that people who do transition have higher incidence of suicide. There was a famous if I'm pronouncing it right, Danish study. And that, I think, gets back to the point where you alluded to all these comorbidities. These are people that have, you know, mental health issues, PTSD, trauma, whatnot. And oftentimes they have three or four of these comorbidities, which have never been addressed, which is what you hear in the stories of the detransitioners. They were told if you medicalize or surgicalize your body, then your problems will go away. And these people went, okay, I did everything the doctors and the experts told me, and I still have these problems that I had before. So there was another study that just came out recently in California that showed men who have, you know, what I'll politely call bottom surgery, have a really high incident rate of suicide when compared to the suicide rates across the national, you know, public standards. And it makes sense. You know, you cut off your genitalia, you know, you can imagine the regret you have. One of the men in my most recent film called The Lost Boys, which is focused only on male detransitioners, you know, he talks about in the film being wheeled into the operating room, and in his mind he's thinking, somebody please help me, somebody please stop me.
That's horrible.
It is.
You know, do me a favor, Jennifer, let's back up, because we know where we are right now. And how more people are beginning to go down this path. There's even TV shows on, you know, cable shows about people who've transitioned or have gone through this. Can you give us a quick history? I mean, where did the whole idea of transgenderism evolve from? Where did it come from? How far back does it date? Is it a relatively new ideology, or does it go back a very long time?
Yeah, it goes back a long time, and I would encourage your listeners to get a copy of the Detransition Diaries book, because we start the book with looking at back and how did we get here today, because it wasn't like it just happened, you know, 10 years ago. And we begin the book, the first chapter, with the story of a Dutch man who was the first man in the early 1900s to have a uterine transplant. Because he thought he was a woman. You know, he was married to a female a wife. She was an artist. She used to have him dress up in women's clothing just so she could paint. She would use him as her subject. And he liked, you know, wearing women's clothing. And then he went on and he actually died of complications of that uterine transplant. You know, there was a quack called Dr. Harry Benjamin who did the first sexual reassignment surgery on Christine Jorgensen. Who was a U.S., you know, Army, retired Army person who decided that he wanted to be a man. So, you know, that was many, many decades ago. And then Alfred Kinsey and John Money, you know, at Johns Hopkins, these are prestigious, you know, universities that were entertaining these notions that sex was ambiguous, sex was changeable. And then, you know, the radical feminist movement, you know, we went from having women's studies to gender studies, and then we had queer studies. Where we just wanted to blur all these distinctions between men and women. We have, you know, non-binary and gender fluid and all this, you know, word salad. of what does it mean to be a human being. So it's a long history, and it's a long history of also, as we chronicle in the book, of medical abuse, you know, beginning with Tuskegee and Nazi Germany and the lobotomy study and the forced sterilization across the United States, where medicine lost its way. And this is another example here when we're looking at transgender medicine and the scandals, you know, looking at the WPATH files that Michael Schellenberger, just released. And the jig is up, Drew.
Wow. It's Frankenscience, really. It's bizarre stuff. You know what I found striking as I was going through your book? I noticed in some of the interviews, pornography played a role in the initial decision to transition. I was taken back by that, but it makes total sense. How does that work? And this is a cautionary tale, again, for anyone who thinks pornography is innocent.
Yeah, and if there's parents listening, you know, our children today have access to things on the internet that, you know, you and I didn't have access to, you know, at the beginning, the early days of the internet, where, you had to wait 30 minutes for your computer to dial in and load up and get, you know, online. And there's so many of these children, when I speak to them, you know, we talk about Chloe Cole, her story's in the book. And Chloe Cole is a young woman in California where I live who's suing Kaiser Permanente because as a young, you know, teenage girl, she had a double mastectomy. And she talks about the fact that she had access to pornography 24/7 as a 9-year-old. And she said, I have had access to pornography nobody should see. So just to give, you know, your audience a sort of a flavor of what these children and the whole internet use and these Reddit groups and Tumblr groups and how the analytics and the algorithms, they know that if a child looked at this, they'll keep, you know, showing them more of this and you know, pulling them further into down the rabbit hole. So, you know, I always tell parents, get your kids offline, get your kids outside, get your kids having friends that you know, personal friends, not friends on the internet. You know, they talk about all their friends on the internet who are oftentimes older men grooming them, presenting as a teenager.
Wow, that's unbelievable. If you want to join us, you know, you have a question, a comment, maybe you can share your experience. Maybe a loved one has gone through this. Maybe you have. Feel free to dial in. The number's 888-914-9149. 888-914-9149. And my guest today, Jennifer Law, came out with a brand new book called The Detransition Diaries. It really is quite enlightening, and the interview's captivating. Maggie, did you want to jump in?
I just found some breaking audio here from Sky News, and this is about the healthcare system in England. Children will no longer be prescribed puberty blockers. Hold on, listen.
And let's just bring you a bit of breaking news, which may be of interest to some of you. It's about puberty blockers. Now, these are drugs that are used to delay the changes of puberty in transgender youngsters. In terms of how they are prescribed by the NHS, there has been a lot of controversy over the last few years about this. At the moment, they are only prescribed to children attending gender identity services as part of clinical research, and they are not routinely offered to children at gender identity clinics, but they are still offered. Well, the government, NHS England, has just confirmed that children will no longer be prescribed puberty blockers at gender identity clinics.
Yeah, that's big news. That broke earlier today, and the only exception there is for those in clinical trials. Jennifer, your thoughts on that news?
Well, it's wonderful. I mean, we've been fed the lie that, you know, you can block puberty, that there's no, you know, detrimental changes to the child's body, that it can be paused, it will buy you time, you know, as the child sorts out these, you know, feelings of confusion of being born in the wrong body. And we know that's not the case. I mean, I was a pediatric critical care nurse for many years, and we know that in human development, puberty plays a very important role in our development, you know, moving us from being children into young adults, into mature adults, into fertile adults that can go on and then have children. And there's so many things that are happening during puberty that if you pause them and you think it's reversible, you can't go through puberty at 27. If you block somebody's puberty, then all of a sudden you say, okay, we're going to take you off puberty blockers at you know, 20 or 25, you don't then go into puberty. You've missed that window. It's closed. And very important things that should have been happening during that time physiologically aren't able to happen.
Wow. There's a strong effort right now. And, you know, it drives me, one of the things in the culture that drives me insane, maybe because I use words, and words are so powerful in helping to express thought and convert heart and to change things. There's a very clear effort right now to change the language of how people speak about all of this. And we've seen stuff like that in the past, haven't we? You know, I don't know if you can speak to that or not. Can you speak to the language that's being now used?
Yeah, I mean, women can no longer be called mothers. You know, if you're pregnant, you're, you know, a birthing person. You know, we are told now that men can have babies.
And chest feeders.
Chest feeders. You know, and again, back to the fact that, you know, Callie Fell, who co-wrote the book with me, The Detransition Diaries, we're both nurses. And, you know, if somebody presents in an emergency room with some kind of medical complaint, it's very important as healthcare providers to know, am I dealing with a man or a female, you know, a woman? Because, you know, the things that we'll look for, you know, if a man presents as a woman, we might be looking for an ectopic pregnancy and then realize, oh, my gosh, she's really a man. he maybe has an appendicitis or something. So the language, I agree, is crucial to, you know, to tether it to biological reality and good, proper medicine and medical ethics.
Let's do this. 888-914-9149. We'll take a few calls for you. Ann is in Fox Valley, Wisconsin. Ann, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Hi. Tomorrow we are having a school board meeting, and this is Divine Providence that I just turned you, your channel on. And we've got to present to the teachers that are on the school board or whoever they are that we do not appreciate having a lot of pornography put in the library books. And this ranges from soft porn to hard porn. How do I go ahead and stress the fact that this is just not a phase of the woke culture, that this is going to be something very detrimental to these kids as they get older? And what I did was I caught you on the Chloe Cole comment that she said she had access to porn, what, for 8 years or since she was eight?
Yes, Jennifer, how long did she have it? Do you know?
Yeah, she said when she was a nine-year-old girl, she had access to pornography on her smartphone.
On her smartphone, huh? Did she say that? Had a terrible effect on her, I would think.
Oh yes, oh yes. And Chloe, by her own admission, is as an autistic child, so just the ability to process things like, I mean, children shouldn't be able to process and understand pornography, let alone a child who has spectrum of autism. So, but back to your point on the school board, I have just been so encouraged by seeing parents in mass. So I hope that you don't go to your school board meeting alone, but you have several other, like-minded family members coming with you to that meeting. I have, cheered on when I've watched parents literally read to the school board, committee what the books say.
Exactly.
And you see these parents getting shut down. They're being told to stop reading it because it's disgusting. And their point is, but it's okay for our children to read it.
Yeah, no kidding. Hey, and I think that's great advice that Jennifer gave you. My advice would just kind of re-echo that. What you want to do is, and I say this to any parent, look, make sure you know what's going on in your kid's school, right? Engage in the newsletters, the websites, the parent-teacher meetings. If you're disconnected, you don't know what your kid's being exposed to. But when you go to protest this type of stuff, before you raise your concern, go over the materials, right, that they're presenting. Know what's in there. That way you can speak to them very clearly. And then reach out to the teacher, the librarian, the school administrator, the board member, whoever it is. Do it with respect, but propose solutions. Say, hey, we don't want it for X, Y, and Z. Here's the studies. Here's the empirical data. And then offer some sort of solutions as to what you might be able to do. And advocate. Advocate, get other parents and other people involved as well. I'm with you, Jennifer. I get all fired up you know, when I see parents stand up to this wokeism, you know, because they're defending and they're protecting their kids' innocence. And I think that's in danger today. So, you know, a lot of public schools, you know, it's not just public. I think it's also Catholic schools, too. You know, it's all sorts of schools. I think people need to know. So it's important that they do their part. Hey, thank you, Anne. I wish you the best in that. I only have a few moments left for you, Jennifer. If people want your book, what's the best way to get it?
Well, they can go directly to Ignatius Press and purchase it there, or it's also available on Amazon if people want to get it there.
Yeah, we're talking about schools and how this stuff gets indoctrinated. We have these drag, you know, queen type of story hours. We've got all these other things that take place. How strong of an influence outside of pornography, which comes over the computer, is social media? Kids may not be looking at porn, but you've got your TikToks, your Instagrams, you got all these other platforms that are out there. Have you found in your research that social media is kind of an undercurrent or playing a role in facilitating this?
I think it's toxic. I would, you know, it'd be like, you know, allowing your children to have access to alcohol. You know, it's toxic to their brain. Their levels of maturity are not able to look at something and go, oh, I need to shut this down. This is not good for me. They don't have that discernment. Yeah. So I do think it's, you know, it's brain rot. I think we will see, we will reap the benefits in generations to come. And a lot of it, you know, really got exacerbated during the COVID lockdowns when children were online all day long and, you know, locked in and didn't have access to, you know, normal friendship, playing outside, going to the park and those kind of things. And I think we will see, you know, lifelong negative implications from the use of internet. The internet has a lot of darkness to it. Yes, it's a good tool and it helps us to navigate and learn new things that we wouldn't otherwise and communicate with the world, but it has, you know, lots of darkness to it, and again, children just don't have the maturity to really navigate and discern where they should be, you know, watching or not.
Well, I'm grateful for the fact that you've done this book. And if anyone has a loved one or has a concern, you may want to check it out. The Detransition Diaries is the name of the book. And it's both personal and historical. It's personal in the fact that it recounts the stories of five women and two men who felt that they were born in the wrong body. And they believed the lie. And unfortunately, you know, they saw the fruit of that. Their stories, they're short, too. I think you did a great job with this, you know, and it's easy read for anybody who wants to pick it up. But the book's also historical because it kind of outlines the history of this whole movement, this gender affirmation movement. And it's not over. You know, if you got kids or grandkids, this stuff is there. And this book will really give you an insight into a world that you may not be that familiar with. Hey, Jennifer, thank you for being here. I'm grateful for your time and for your writing. Keep up your good work, okay?
Thank you. God bless.
God bless you. That's Jennifer Law, one of the co-authors of the book, The Detransition Diaries, along with Callie Fell. Like I said, it's a good read. It's an easy read. Maybe it belongs in your school's library. All right, so check it out at Ignatius. I need to take a short pause. We'll be back with more right after this.
The Drew Mariani Show. Connected. Connected. Relevant Radio.
Hey, today we'd like to thank Santi, who's listening in Maine, for donating his 1983 Jaguar XJ6. You can join thousands of other listeners in donating old vehicles, trucks, boats, and RVs by visiting relevantradio.com/car. That's relevantradio.com/car. There you go, little Doobie Brothers, China Grove. Good afternoon and welcome. Great to hang out with you. I always enjoy the time we get to spend together, and I'm grateful for it. If you are just joining me, thanks for hanging out. If you missed anything today, check out our podcast. I'm telling you what, some great conversations throughout the day. Everything from dreams to what you are drinking in your water. Kind of a sobering show. Check it out. It's well worth listening to. I don't think you'll be disappointed. There's something I've been following for a long time, and that is China. China, without question, right now has risen to be America's greatest challenge. And for years, the friend of the show, Dr. Paul Kengor, who is a regular here, he wrote a book a while ago. It was called The Devil and Karl Marx, Communism's Long March of Death, Deception and Infiltration. Look, anyone with eyes, you can see that communism clearly is anti-God, right? Therefore, it's an anti-human system. The hundreds of millions of people who've been killed by these regimes that embrace this godless form of politics, they far outweigh Hitler's atrocities in Nazi Germany. I mean, everybody thinks of what happened in World War II. You take a look at these type of totalitarian governments. You take a look at the rejection and actually the banning of God, these anti-Catholic regimes. You see what communism has done. Boy, you see the fingerprints of the evil one all over it. And I think we got to be clear on this because there are people who want to confuse the situation. They'll say, oh, what happened in the Soviet Union and Cambodia and Vietnam and Cuba and North Korea and China, that was communism, but it was communism badly implemented. That's obviously not how the communist leaders who did it saw it. What they did, they thought they were implementing was just fine. It was those hundreds of millions of people who suffered and died at their hands who were getting in the way. Those poor schlubs who had just gone along, you know, with having their property confiscated, being told to do the job they were told to do, whether they liked it or not, being forced to move to a completely different region, having their children taken away from them so they could, you know, raise them in state daycares, or being told not to have children. No, everything will be a lot easier for you, you know? You'll live to a ripe old age. We found out, you know, they found out the lie, of course, but we found out from Dr. Kengor, in his book, that Karl Marx, his sidekick, Friedrich Engels, they were far worse than just bad men. They were in a league with the devil, he makes the case. It's a good read. You should check out the book. Today, I think the same could be said for the leader of the Communist Party, Xi Jinping. In fact, the same could be said for the leaders of Communist China and from Mao to Xi. I mean, Steve Mosier, who is the president of the Population Research Institute, for a long time, he's been to China. He's talked about their one-child policy for a long time. He's recognized as one of the world's leading authorities on this whole population question, especially in China. But I hope you'll check him out. He came out with a new book. Now, his book's entitled The Devil in Communist China, From Mao Down to Xi. And his website is pop.org, P-O-P.org. He joins me today. Hey, Steve, thank you for your time. Good afternoon, and congratulations on an excellent book.
Well, thank you. I talked to Paul Kengor years ago, and he said, you know, we've got this series coming out. You're the guy to write The Devil and Communist China. Wow. And that's what I spent much of last year doing.
Yeah.
It was even for me, who has been reading about the horrors and the atrocities of the Chinese Communist Party, to go back and look at Mao's early days, when he, at 3 years old, he was taken by his mother and given a kind of second baptism and a new name at a monolith outside the village that was thought to be inhabited by spirits. So he was actually consecrated to a diabolical influence. Wow. At 3 years of age.
Wow, that explains it.
That makes, in light of what happened later, I think that has a lot of explanatory ability here.
How many people died under Mao's reign? Was it 45 million plus or minus? What was the number? 60 million? How many people died?
Oh, I'm going to say that it's 100 million.
Wow.
Half of that occurred in the famine after the Great Leap Forward. It was a man-made famine, true.
Yeah, yeah.
He destroyed the agricultural economy. He forced everyone into communes. He took husbands away from wives, children away from their parents, forced everybody to live in dormitories. Plants didn't get harvested. They didn't get planted. They didn't get fertilized. And famine set in very quickly. That's half the death toll right there. But there are many, many millions of others who died in the Cultural Revolution, the Great Leap Forward,
yeah.
A non-ending series of political campaigns. And Mao was actually responsible, people don't know this, for the one-child policy. Now, he died in 1976 before the one-child policy began when I was in China. But in 1958, he said that the government should control reproduction in the same way that it controls production. So he's the one who put in place the idea behind the one-child policy, that the Communist Party should dictate how many children you have and when you would have them. So I hold that, I am responsible for that as well.
Yeah, what a mess that was. And we've got a lot to talk about, but that whole one-child policy, it's funny how they were kind of blind to, you know, the problems that would arise from that, from gender imbalances, everybody wanting a male child and terminating a lot of the females, the aging populations, so even human rights concerns, you know, the whole family structure and social support just messed up. They went to two-child in China, right? And have they changed that now? Have they gone beyond two-child?
Oh, they're three children. And
so there's still a limit, though, right?
Young, well, in the province of Sichuan, 110 million people in the interior, they're saying to the Chinese people, go ahead and have as many children as you want.
Oh, wow.
The trouble is, 40 years of antinatal propaganda have done their work. Chinese young people don't want to get married. If they get married, they don't want to have children or more than one. So I think we're looking down the road at forced pregnancy. You know, communism is so evil. At the center of communism is a hatred of God, a hatred of human life. And, of course, the devil's greatest success is destroying souls. But second to that is destroying bodies. That's why the evil one embraces abortion.
You know, Xi Jinping today is trying to sinize all religions, which means to make them completely about China. And besides the physical destruction that's happening because of that particular ideology, you know, he is, his role is created incredible persecution, especially for Catholics, as you know. You talked about Mao's demonic, you know, overshadowing, if I can put it that way. What about Xi and this attack on religion and on life and this current leader? What do you know about Xi Jinping?
Well, what we know about Xi Jinping is he models himself in every detail on Mao Zedong. He models himself on the evil genius who was Mao himself. And Mao was a very intelligent man, but from the very beginning, he wrote as a young man that there are other people and things in the world, but they are there only for my pleasure.
Whoa.
He thought the entire world existed just for him, which, of course, is the ancient promise of the serpent, right?
Mm-hmm.
You shall be as gods. He bought into that hook, line, and sinker. And Xi Jinping wants to be and is the second Mao.
Wow. And my guest today, Steve Mosher. If you want to join us, the number's 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. Well, he's achieved that practically, Steve. You know, I don't know of any force in China that can challenge his power right now.
No, absolutely not. He has almost total control of the population. He runs a high-tech digital dictatorship. You know, when I arrived in China in 1979, there were loudspeakers blaring from morning to night. Morning to night, you couldn't get away from the noise. And what they were blaring were the speeches of Mao Zedong over and over and over again. It was enough to drive you mad. Well, right now, of course, they've turned off the loudspeakers, but they're on your phone. They're on your computer. They're watching all the time using surveillance cameras and artificial intelligence. So the controls are actually tighter now than they were under Mao because of the technological advances.
Yeah. You know, first, I'm glad you wrote the book, you know, The Devil and Communist China. I think people should read it. I think it's important at this particular moment in history. Maybe you can speak to that, the timing of this and how you think it'll help those who pick it up. But I'd love you also to elaborate, if you could, on the concept of communism as being anti-gospel as well. Because, you know, in Fatima, as you know, Our Lady told us to pray the rosary for the fall of communism. We saw, you know, with the collapse of the Berlin Wall, the Iron Curtain ultimately collapsed, John Paul's consecration. But there are still vestiges of communism. It seems to be rearing its ugly head, especially in China. Can you talk about the concept of communism being both anti-gospel and how critical it is that we understand this particular moment in history and how wrong this can go?
Well, how I approach Mao is by looking at the Ten Commandments, because they're written on the human heart. And so when we talk about the fifth commandment, thou shalt not kill, I quote Matthew chapter 5, you've heard it said that you shall not kill. And then I quote Chairman Mao. If we were to add up all the landlords, rich peasants, and counter-revolutionaries, bad elements, their number would reach 30 million. Our total population is 600 million. Those 30 million are only 1 out of 20. So what's there to be afraid of? We have too many people. We can afford to lose a few. Wow. Now, he's talking about killing, Drew, 30 million people. Wow. This was back in the 50s. He far exceeded that number. Yeah. But in every chapter, I reflect on the good before addressing the evil, and I come back to the good at the end, because you cannot spend too much time contemplating evil without reflecting on the good.
Yeah, no kidding. That sounds like a sociopathic tendency that he has there. You know, let's just take out 30 million people. You know, we got enough people. Steve, hold the thought. I got to take a quick break. When we come back, let's talk a little bit more. Final segment of my show is coming up. So if you want to join Steve Mosher, he's the founder of the Population Research Institute. You check him out at pop.org. You can also check out his brand new book that is out. I think you'll enjoy reading it, The Devil in Communist China, from Mao to Xi. And we'll continue with more conversation right after this. Stay with me.
We go there. The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio app.
Sponsor of the University of Dallas, the Catholic University for Independent Thinkers, invites high school juniors, seniors, and recent graduates to study the great books this summer at UD's two-week-long Arete program while earning 3 hours of college credit. Info at relevantradio.com/UDallas.
Get informed and get connected. It's the Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Yeah, hey, thanks for joining me. If you are just tuning in, joined by the founder of the Population Research Institute, Steve Mosher. I've known him for years. He's always warned about China's one-child policy. He's been to China. China is a rising threat, not just economically or militarily in the world today, but really the ideology is a poison. Like Russia, who spread its errors, China continues to spread their errors. I mean, they're spreading communism to North Korea and to so many other places. Steve Mosher's book is called The Devil in Communist China, from Mao to Xi. And it's just, if you're going to check it out, it's not another academic critique. It's really a profound wake-up call of about two decade-long research by him. And as you go through this, it's kind of a chilling narrative that exposes the diabolic essence of communism. And I think that's how you have to look at this. There's a diabolic nature to communism, a force that, contrary to what I think a lot of Americans might believe, it's not a relic of the past, but it's a present and looming threat. And what he does is he kind of pierces that veil of the political and economic discussions that surround communism. And he looks at what I think is really the most important, the spiritual ramifications, and argues that communism is the anti-gospel. It's a malevolent force that wants to usurp God's place and turn mankind away from their creator with the promise of all these false utopias. This is the day, this is the time you and I are chosen to live. I mean, I look at how active this demonic spirit is around the world, from governments to the attack on our children. I mean, you know it. I talk about this stuff a lot, but through the lens of communist China, he says, look, this is not an aberration of Marxist ideals, but really it's the fulfillment. It's the realization of a dystopia that Marx and the devil envisioned. So you might want to check out the book. I think it's a fascinating read. And Steve, it's good to have you back with us. Let's take a few calls. Well, before I go to Mercedes, who lived under communism, and other calls, your thoughts on that, the spiritual. You know, I always try to look at things through the eyes of the spirit, if you will, you know, and see through the falsities of sometimes the temporal. Do you see this demonic spirit, really manifesting in a particular way through communism today?
Oh, absolutely. And Mao Zedong himself said that he was, in Chinese, Wu Fa Wu Tian, which means he was lawless and godless. And so from a very young age, he not only rejected God, he rejected everything that was good and true and beautiful. We already talked about the Great Famine after the Great Leap Forward in the early 1960s. Mao said when people started starving that the people could live on tree bark and grass.
Yeah.
Later, when tens of millions of people began to die of starvation, he said, when there's not enough to eat, people starve to death. It's better to let half the people die so the other half can eat their fill. Deaths have benefits, Mao said. They fertilize the ground. That was his view of the people that he happened to be born into. Wow. He had absolute disdain for his fellow Chinese. And, of course, he was absolutely unfaithful, unfilial. He was a faithless husband and an absentee father. I mean, the catechism tells us that either man governs his passions and finds peace, or he lets himself be dominated by his passions and becomes unhappy.
Yeah,
so what does Mao say? He says, I'm a great hero, and I give full play to my impulses. They are magnificently powerful, stormy, and invincible. He's totally self-absorbed, totally under the control of a demonic spirit that prevents him from connecting with anything good and leaves him in the clutches of the devil, in my view.
He slept with, what, 1,000 women? Or he wanted to sleep with 1,000 women?
Oh, the number was far greater than that. But what he did at the end of his life, he was worried he was getting older. He was in his 60s. And he read about an ancient Chinese emperor who had supposedly achieved immortality by sleeping with 1,000 virgins. And so what he did was he had his secret police start going out in China's villages and bringing beautiful young girls to him, 12 and 13 and 14, night after night, because he was determined to achieve immortality by sleeping with 1,000 virgins.
No.
And, you know, he didn't take care of them.
No,
he just brought them in, used them, and then sent them back to their village. Even in the old days, you know, I'm not a fan of the fact that the emperors had multiple wives, but even the concubines were taken care of by the emperors.
Yeah.
They were given food and shelter and clothing for the rest of their life. They did have a certain status. Mao just used them and threw them away. Why? Because he was a great hero.
He's
and
evil.
Other people, he said, exist only for my pleasure.
Yeah, it's demonic. It's evil. Mercedes is in Miami, Florida. She was born in a communist country. Mercedes, thanks for calling. Good afternoon.
Yes, good afternoon. Thank you. I just want for everyone to learn what I went through as a little girl. I was 7 when we left the country, and I left the country of Cuba with my family, mm-hmm. and what they would do is, like, in first grade, second grade, they would take us out of the classroom and go into a hallway with a picture of the dictator, which I don't even want to say his name. I'll just say his initials, FC, and they would tell us to look at him, and who is that, they would ask. And we had to say, that's God.
Oh.
And then since we did celebrate the Three Kings Day, which is January the 6th, they would ask us, and who is that? Is that the Three Kings? Does he represent the Three Kings that bring you gifts? And we had to say, oh, yes, he is. So that's how it would indoctrinate our minds. So religion taken out, family taken out. It's the saddest thing on planet Earth. Yes.
Well, I am glad you're in the United States, Mercedes, and we need to hear more voices.
I am. We're the proudest people in this country,
Amen.
Which has given us everything that we lost over there.
Mercedes, do you see the U.S. moving at all towards a socialistic bent, if you will?
And you know what? That saddens me, because it is, and a lot of young people do not comprehend what that means. And they think it's others. They think it's something good, and it's totally the opposite. Once they get a hold of you and your family, that's the end of you and your family.
Well, Mercedes, thank you for sharing. And Steve, I want to pick up on what she said, because you see what happens, and I'm sure this is all chronicled in your book as well, where these authorities, they want to dismantle religious expression. They want to supplant divine worship with state allegiance like that, and it's not merely a political maneuver. It's really a direct attack on spiritual life and the faith. Churches are transformed into propaganda centers, Bibles, you know, exchanged for political manifestos. The very image of Christ is replaced with, you know, leaders like Fidel Castro or Mao or Xi or whoever it might be. What did you make of Mercedes' thoughts? And this is, you know, in America, we're not to this point, but this is kind of the end of what ultimately happens when suddenly the state becomes the religion and the leader, the God.
Well, and that's exactly what happened in China. Once Mao Zedong took power, his picture was everywhere. Family altars were destroyed and pictures of Chairman Mao were put up everywhere. You had to have a picture of Mao Zedong in your house, and you had to kowtow to him. The same thing is happening now. You've got Xi Jinping, the new head of the Chinese Communist Party, who is trying to present himself as a deity, as a god to the Chinese people. And we have a Xi Jinping app on people's phones where they're expected to read his collected works, a little section each day, like the way some of us go through a yearly Bible, right?
Wow.
That's what you have to go through if you're in China, member of the Chinese Communist Party. You have to read the sayings of Xi Jinping every day. So it is an evil cult. And of course, they're carrying out a vicious war on Catholics right now, and not just on Catholics, on all religions, because beginning with Chairman Mao, Mao believed that belief in God would stand in the way of his totalitarian ambitions. And so everyone was supposed to reject God on his orders and worship him instead.
Wow.
It's
wild. Iris is in San Luis Obispo, California. Let me scrap her. We only have a few minutes to try to get a few more calls. Iris, good afternoon.
Hi, Drew. Thank you. Love your show.
Thanks.
Thank you for this discussion.
Thank you.
I have a question. Just because I always try to think, what could we do or what went on? How did society get to a point that people actually got behind that? I know they realized it was evil once it was too late.
Right.
But how do societies get to the point where they back something like that? And I'm going to hang up and listen to the answer.
Thanks, Iris. Appreciate it. So her question to you, you know, what's missing in society for people to get behind a communist movement and embrace it as a good?
Well, I think when that happens, the Christians, the Catholic, and the population have failed to preach adequately the good and the true and the beautiful.
Amen.
And so other evil preachers come in and promise heaven on earth. The old ancient temptation of the serpent in the garden, right? Mm-hmm. If you eat of the fruit of the tree, you will be as gods. If you eat of the fruit of communism, you will be as gods. Well, of course, the only god in that equation, demigod, false god, are the leaders of the Chinese Communist Party themselves. And the fruit is, as it has always been, rotten. And it leads not to heaven on earth, but to hell, which again is another victory of the devil, who would rather reign in hell than serve in heaven. Mao Zedong, Xi Jinping would rather reign in hell, create hell on earth for the Chinese people, than serve. Then recognize that there's a higher being, that we all as human beings have a higher calling.
That's so true. Steve, I have less than a minute to go. My apologies again to everyone who's trying to get through. How could someone get your book? If someone says, hey, I'd like to learn more about this, what's the best way to connect?
Well, it was published by Tan Books. It's the third in the series of The Devil and Karl Marx, edited by Paul Kinker. So you can get it from tanbooks.com. You can get it from pop.org, pop.org. I'll send you a signed copy. Or, of course, you can go on Amazon. So it's out now and widely available.
Pop.org, if you want a signed copy. That's always cool. I love having the signature of the author. That's Stephen Mosher, author of that book. I'm out of time for the day. Stay tuned. Kale Clark is coming straight up.